We smoking straight Japanese roses. That's those idiot seeds what blasted me back to 13th century Poland. My efficiency rating never recovered. They wanted me to stand winter guard duty, but I was higher than anyone in this century. Catch me in the sauna at Okowitz knocking back a wooden tall boy. Sir Stefan tried to stunt on me. I summoned a familiar and gave him gonorrhea from the future. I can't slide into anyone's DMs in the year 1231, and my horse can't fucking spell. Still hitting it nightly, cause ain't nobody invented feminism. I nearly drowned in wenches last Michaelmas. A priest swore me to secrecy, so they don't know that I'm him.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.
Welcome to the Socialist Shelf. I don't know who that was. Apparently, Dracula showed up from Dracula Flow. Not sure what Dracula was doing here. Dracula has since vanished. I'm not sure what was happening. But
you know what? It's a spooky season. You know,
it's a spooky season of February. But we today are discussing the cross time engineer. Dracula, you know, just kind of gave us some details on it, but Dracula was alive back, you know, when this was happening, presumably, and remains alive to this very day.
Famously, he's 12 million years old.
Yeah, but for us, we have to time travel to get back to the 12th century. And so does Leo Frankowski's stand-in characters. But this was a book I had never heard of until Lenore introduced me to it. Lenore, you want to let people know what's the deal with this book? What made you want to cover Leo Frankowski's The Cross Time Engineer?
Yes. So this has been simmering in the back of my mind for quite a while because, you know, growing up, my family would, we all read together most nights. You know, we started out on things like the Harry Potter series and we, you know, did Aragon as well. Somewhere in this dead spot between Harry Potter 4 and 5, my father introduced us to the Conrad Stargard series written by, Leo Frankowski. I was about 11 years old, and I was way too young to read this shit. As we will find out, as I have come to sort of conceive of this stretch of episodes, Leo Frankowski is a fitting cap to Weird Little Guy Winter.
Weird Little Guy Winter, I like
yes.
that.
Yes, the premise, of course, is Conrad Stargard is our protagonist. He is an engineer from late Soviet era Poland, and he falls asleep in a time machine one night, and he wakes up in 13th century Poland, 10 years, his understanding of history tells him, before the Mongol invasion. So he has that time to get together an industrial base, to make a name for himself, to unite the country, and make sure that they don't all get slaughtered by the Mongol hordes. Fantastic concept, you know. The execution, I think...
Team 7 looks great, yeah.
Yeah. The execution, oh boy. We'll have some thoughts about that.
And it was written in the 1980s too. So, you know, it's writing from like kind of a modern day man goes back in time, which is like an important context. Cause I was like, I was wondering, cause you know, Poland was socialist in it. So I was like, let me check when this was written. Yeah. 1986, I believe, mm-hmm. is the publication of this book. So they were being published until like the early 2000s.
Yes, and we'll get into the rocky publishing history of this series. You know, Frankowski, of course, himself Polish. He considers himself an authority on the culture and the history. to varying degrees he is. But there's also just some straight up nonsense in here that we'll get into. Oh
All
boy, is
right, let's
there.
hear about Leo Frankowski. First Polish person we've covered on the podcast, I guess Polish American.
Yes, Polish American.
Okay,
Born.
well, apologies if we like find out Upton Sinclair was like part Polish or something, but like we're gonna just say first Polish American on the pod.
Yes, and doubtless we will find better polls as the series goes on. So he was born February 13th, 1943, in Detroit.
Wait. A lot of this book is just asking how many poles it takes to change a light bulb, or create the light bulb rather.
He does return to like several Polish jokes, because like through bizarre coincidences. I mean, part of his conceit, right, is that if you're an engineer, like there's hundreds of solutions, hundreds of practical solutions, for any given problem, right? And part of arriving at one is just, time and place, right? And so through some coincidences, they do things backward, perhaps, from where he originally thought they might have to solve a particular problem. So he's like, "Look, I know we're Polish, but do we have to do everything backwards?" Like, that's a running joke.
Got him.
So yeah, he again, another one for the coincidence nexus. He was born February 13th, 1943. Earlier this week would have been his 81st birthday. I say would have been. He's dead now. In Detroit was where he was born. Now, information on this guy is kind of scarce. It's gleaned largely from about the author sections of his books and from his website. Now, the bio from Crosstime Engineer mentions that by the time he was 35, he had held more than 100 different positions, from scientist in an electro-optics research lab to gardener to chief engineer. He worked in chemical, optical, and physical instrumentation. He held 7 patents in his time. So he's I don't want to say dilettante, right? But he's a jack of many trades, right? And it really comes through in this book, because a lot of it, a good quarter of it actually, is really, really dry, like engineering exposition. From 1977, he was owner and operator of Sterling Manufacturing and Design. According to the Crosstime Engineer bio again, it was the only mostly female engineering company in the Detroit area. I wasn't able to find any more information about that. I imagine he selected for attractiveness, because he
Yeah,
was
I'm
that
sure he
kind of
was really
guy.
normal about that.
Oh yes, active in Mensa, active in the Society for Creative
Of course, he was
Anachronism.
active in Minso. My
Oh,
God.
yeah, no, like there was a review of one of his books that mentions that, and is like, yeah, if somebody says they're active in Mensa, it's because they don't have any other like claim to particular intelligence, and it really shows. He's an officer in two writers' clubs in as of the Crosstime Engineer bio. His hobbies included reading, drinking, chess, kite flying, dancing girls, and cooking. So that kind of sets the stage for what we'll hear of him. He's a hobbyist writer throughout his engineering career, but in the early 1980s, he starts writing seriously. He is encouraged in this by an invite to the National Science Fiction Writers Exchange, which was founded by his buddy, fellow fiction writer Guy Snyder. It's kind of like the Inklings, but for Detroit, right? And apparently, Snyder kept audio recordings of these meetings, which I am morbidly curious about. Snyder, come on the pod. You're still alive. Now, in 1986, his literary efforts, Frankowski's literary efforts, bear fruit. He starts writing the Crosstime. He writes the Crosstime Engineer, and he, as he puts it, he'd become interested in medieval technology, right? And he wrote something along the lines of a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court. That was his goal.
We'll get to Mark Twain eventually.
Oh, we will. Yes,
Maybe
yeah, that's
not
on the
that one,
list.
but we'll get to something.
Oh yeah,
Letters
Mark
from the
Twain.
Earth, maybe. His
Ooh, yes.
very little known novel that what? It took like 100 years to publish or some shit? Crazy.
Wow, long letters.
It was kind of blasphemous. So I think they kept it locked up, if I remember correctly.
So Frankowski says of his book, "When I read some of the first bits to the group, Charles Oliver, one of the members of the group, slammed it. Jacob, this is the part I told you about, right? He said that my narrator was nothing more or less than Leo Frankowski, and he didn't see how anyone could call that real writing. Miffed, I went home and outlined a character who was absolutely not me. I am a fat, unathletic person. Conrad became tall and muscular. I'm a dyed-in-the-Kevlar capitalist, so Conrad became a socialist. I'm an atheist, so Conrad became a devout Catholic. I hated my mother, so he was still living happily with his at 28. And so on. Now many fans I meet are saddened to find that I am not Conrad. Go figure." Again, like Conrad is a bit of a Gary Stu as we go on, but again, This is what sort of piqued my interest, right? The process of coming up with this guy was a genuine a writing challenge, right? From the perspective of a, as we'll find out, libertarian atheist, you write a good Catholic socialist. How accurately, how honestly that comes across, I think he's a better Catholic than he is a socialist in this book.
Yeah, I think the book even would, the book kind of portrays him as such. Yeah, a lot of this does feel like a guy on the internet, like nowadays, like getting on Reddit and being like, I bet the Chads do this on with, on the weekend, and they get all the girls and they whatever. Stargard feels like the idea, like in like modern, like Chad versus Virgin memes, it feels like he created like a Chad version of himself. I know that's
He's,
not
yeah.
entirely what he tried to do, because he tried to be like ideologically different and like does have subtle jabs at his ideology throughout it. But like a lot of it, especially with his like relationship to women, his capacity for combat, I mean, just being smarter than everybody
He's
at
a
a
Renaissance man before the Renaissance.
yeah. A pre he's ushering in the Renaissance early. So yeah, I maybe there's something of the own author's like inferiority, like even going into this character. There feels to be some like weird stuff, some weird psychology behind this creation of Stargard. But it's
Oh
interesting that
boy.
he's not like an entirely self-insert, though I would say that like I still think he sees Stargard as him in some capacity.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like he there's definitely a cross some overlap between, Conrad Stargard's expertise and interests and Frankowski's own. Now, if it seems like this book ends suddenly, Jacob, it's because his original draft was 400 pages long, and that only got him 6 months into his 10-year timeline. So he cut it at a logical stopping point and shipped it. And shipped it. And shipped it. It gets rejected 8 times before somebody at Delray Books picks it up, decides he likes it, and offers him a 4-book contract and a $20,000 advance. This is in
The 80s
1986.
were insane. They're just like, yeah, sure. Yeah, one guy's like, yeah, whatever. Four books. It's like, what the
And after, I mean, I can't emphasize enough just how big a turnaround this is for him. He says that after 12 years of seriously trying to write, it's the first money he made writing. Now,
Well,
Costum Engineer.
I am happy to see someone who's worked hard get ahead, but it is funny like how sudden that shit is.
He comes by it honestly, and that's the thing, right? Sometimes you just get dumb shit lucky. Now, it places fifth, Costum Engineer does, in the Locus Awards for Best First Novel in 1987, is nominated for a Compton Crook Award for Best First Novel, places sixth for a John W. Campbell. The first three for the Campbell, incidentally, were Karen Joy Fowler, Lois McMaster Behold, and No Award.
No award.
I don't know. I have this
Redacted.
from the Internet Science Fiction Database. Maybe it's a missing entry, but like it's incredibly funny to me that he lost to, nobody.
Yeah, it was like a book that like criticizing the Reagan administration or something. Just deleted from existence.
It's like a fortune teller told him, "You will lose to nobody," So he writes a
Yeah,
statement.
shout out to Nikki Haley.
Yes.
Fucking
Oh
the
boy.
death ass way to lose the election. You will lose to no man.
So he writes a standalone novel, Copernic's Rebellion, in 1987. Part of the reason is that the rest of the Conrad Stargard series is delayed by disputes with his publisher. He notes that the boss of the guy who signed him to Del Rey wanted to call his second book The Dayglow Night, which he had very strong words about.
The day glow night.
The Dayglow Night, yeah.
And
He
what did
said
he end up going with?
he ended up going with the best title in the series for the best book in the series, The High Tech Night.
Yeah, I like that better.
Yeah.
I'll take Frankowski's guide on this one.
No, yeah, credit where it's due. So in 1989, finally, he drops the other three books in the series. The High Tech Knight comes in March. Radiant Warrior comes in July. The Flying Warlord comes in October. High Tech Knight, actually, he was very proud of to have said that he wrote it in 3 weeks, which, again, I think it's the best book in the series. It's got the best arc, certainly. 3 weeks.
Shades of Lewis here, just churning out these books, and like actually the publisher making him slow down, not him.
Yeah. I mean, he had plenty of time, certainly. His musings on his books are kind of interesting. He on his website, which is his website is roundly awful, but from his post on the Radiant Warrior, he says, as I said earlier, one of the things I had tried to emphasize throughout this series was that every engineering problem has hundreds, even thousands of practical solutions. There are a lot of ways to skin a cat. Which one turns out to be best depends on the political, economic, and technical situation of the time and place that you are in. Again, Perfectly sound analysis. Now, it's during the Flying Warlord's writing that his old writer's club ultimately blows up, as he describes it. Now, that's fine. It was a good launching point for him. Del Rey likes the performance of the Conrad Stargard series as translated. I saw in the books that it was translated into three languages. I could only find the Italian versions. In 1990,
you have
though,
to assume Polish, right?
One assumes it would be it would be criminal if not. Yeah.
Right.
So he follows up in 1990 with Lord Conrad's Lady, and in 1998 with Conrad's Quest for Rubber. Now, Conrad's in that last one a little bit, but it mostly focuses on this other character, Josip Sobieski. So it's
he's
not
doing imperialism in that one, right? I read the Wikipedia summary.
Yeah, he's going to the Amazon and looking for rubber, and it's not well received. People are like, it's the initial reaction to write in from Metal Gear Solid 2, right? You know, people are like, who is this kid? Give me my other protagonist. It's also very notable for a reason that I'll get into a little bit later. He's working on Lord Conrad's Crusade at this time, but. Meanwhile, in 1999, his other standalone, The Fata Morgana, gets him dumped by Del Rey. And what's hilarious is that in his post about that book, in the process of getting it published, he rails against mandatory thought control and political correctness getting him canned from Del Rey. And then a few paragraphs later, he drops the N-word.
And sorry, why did he get canned for that book? What was in it that was so offensive?
Among other things, he brings up an extended sequence about people like discussing the characters in the book, discussing like the Latin like origins and development of the N-word, you know. So
presumably say, it's got to be like a lot because like this book's got some pretty racist shit in it.
Like, oh, already, dude. So, like, I mean, he drops the R slur in Radiant Warrior and not the one you're thinking of.
He also, and obviously, I mean, we'll get into the misogyny, but I was going to say it's got to be pretty far. I mean, like saying PC culture is like fucking over. It's like he's gotta have gone pretty far because like clearly he's got at least a baseline he can go to here.
Yeah, and of course he's undaunted. From his website, I am very proud to say that the twit who dumped me from the Del Rey list was the same bitch who dumped Robert Heinlein. To be placed in such glorious company swells my head more than any award. But at the time, it really knocked me down into the dumps. My God, was brutal poverty going to force me to go out and find an honest job? In all caps, job.
I mean, relatable.
Yeah. You know, it's there are bits and there are shades. Yes. So he gets picked up ultimately by Bane Books. Jim Bane is still heading it up at this time. They publish Fata Morgana. They publish A Boy and His Tank in 1999. That latter one is from the new Kashubia series. It's funny, like it kind of prefigures Halo because it's the main character is this kid who gets thrown onto the front lines. He's a super soldier who. The dude Aragonist is basically Cortana, like this sexy AI that that is his tank.
Is how old is the AI?
Young.
Of course.
So he plans 6 books for that one, but by the third one in 04, Bane tells him to knock it off and put out shit that actually sells. They publish Conrad's Time Machine in 2002, which is not about Conrad. It's about the three guys who invent time travel and who start the Historical Core, which is the group that ultimately causes the whole events of this Conrad Stargard series, right? It's their time machine that Conrad falls asleep in. Now, basically, it's a modern-day power fantasy of the sort that his group castigated him for back before the first book, right? The three guys in it are all him. Another author friend of his, Dave Grossman, helped him write it and a few other of his books. He didn't want co-author credit on Conrad's Time Machine because it's bawdy as hell and Grossman was a staunch Christian. In 2003, he moves to Russia and he lays out explicitly why on his website, because Bush's America is too woke for him.
Jesus. So he goes to Russia.
Yeah, where there are mail order brides. Like post-Soviet Eastern Europe, as we find out, is the only place he can get a date. He says he goes on dates with hundreds of women before he settles on Marina, is her name, who herself owns a mail order bride business.
Interesting, because in this book, the bio in this book, the copy that I read, calls him a lifelong bachelor, which is, I think, what got the wheels turning on this Chad versus Virgin meme shit in my head. But I guess going over to, Russia and also the remnants of this land that he's writing about in these books, the sort of destroyed post-Soviet countries that are still in 2003. I mean, they're real to this day, no doubt. And obviously the political consequences real will always be around. But 2003, you still have very much just like straight up, a lot of systems have not quite been properly like reintroduced. Like there's
straight
up stuff that like I mean, there are questions when a government collapses of who is going to do X, you know, any government would deal with, and those take longer than a decade. So yeah, he's going into this very, I don't like to hear that, but I'm also not surprised.
Yeah, I mean, the longest essay on his site is on how hot Russian women are. From that essay, most of them have a regular exercise routine, and despite the general poorness of the country, spas, gymnasiums, ice skating rinks, swimming pools, saunas, stadiums, and various sport facilities are available to everyone at little or no cost. He doesn't seem to make the connection between the infrastructure and the central economic planning from the Soviet Union that he elsewhere decries. He lays out in that essay his theory of accidental eugenics that produced the hottest women in history. I won't get into it because it's vile, but you know, worth noting, he really hates Stalin, of course. Funnily enough, he also hates Lincoln, who he says did his best to be as criminally savage as Stalin was. Rabid, rabid
As in
anti-communist.
Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln, yeah.
Sorry. So is he like a South Will Rise Again guy from Detroit?
I adjacent. He also really likes Native Americans because they're good at war.
That feels like a you know, it's interesting. I don't know this guy's politics that much, but like it's interesting. There are like a type of like fascist, like European fascist who like idolize Native Americans, not because of who the natives were or anything about them, but because of this sort of myth of like true humans living in true
Yes.
lands. And it's not in their way they imagine natives living is just simply not how they lived. You know, it's through no fault of Native Americans' own that these freaks latched onto them.
Oh
But it
yeah, no,
reminds me of kind of
the
like
Nazis
tangential to that.
loved, yeah, the Nazis loved like cowboy and Indian stories, you
Yeah,
know.
but not like, you know, again, like to make sure our position on this is completely clear, it's nothing to do with the natives' behavior and everything to do with these people being like weird fetishistic, like
Yeah, no,
freaks.
absolutely. Absolutely. Like these people are freaks. So he marries Marina, he gets a teenage daughter in the bargain. Lord Conrad's Crusade, he finally self-publishes in 05 because by that time Bain had had enough of him and rejected it for bad writing. Now he's living it up in Tver. At this time, he gets into real estate flipping. He even starts building a castle, which you can see on the back cover of Lord Conrad's Crusade or on his website.
Does he
But
finish it?
no, he ultimately he doesn't finish it. His marriage fails. He goes back to America in 07. Now, he has more Conrad planned, but he ultimately dies on Christmas Day in 2008 in Lake Elsinore, California, before he can put any out. His writing buddy Roger Olson finishes Conrad's last campaign and self-publishes it in 2014, and that is the last that we see of Frankowski.
And have you read all of these books?
So I have read the first four books. And here we'll get into myself a little bit. The books are a problematic fave of mine, a very problematic fave. You know, I like the dialogue, I like the prose. I read them maybe once a year. You know, because they're eminently readable. You know, they are a fun romp, you know, engineering bullshit aside. I have flipped through books 5 and 6. I haven't tackled 7 and 8 and Lord Con and Conrad's Time Machine yet, but the first four I vividly recall.
Interesting. Yeah, and to sort of you gave the premise at the beginning, but yeah, this Polish engineer from the 1980s gets sent back in time till 10 years before the Mongol invasion of Poland. And this book is kind of him finding his bearings, figuring it out, getting his placement at this sort of underneath this sort of lord and starting to find his place, introducing modern methodology into a medieval setting. My understanding is through the series, he grows more and more powerful. He has, you know, develops more, their technology progresses, and the series kind of concludes with him crushing the Mongols. And before we get too far ahead of ourselves,
But I
you know,
get
we'll
ahead of
get into
myself, as he says.
Right. I mean, we'll get into the details, but I just have to ask for my own curiosity. It says at one point in this that there's only one timeline and you can't change time. So can he change time or not?
So it's interesting, right? Because starting in about book three and then really taking off in book four, you have I mean, throughout the series you have these interludes where his cousin, who happens to be one of the three founders of the of the time traveling company that starts this all. His cousin and one of his co-workers are watching Conrad's adventures, right, through drones that they sent back in time. That's the whole frame story. And as it goes on, they realize, wait a minute, we're seeing two different versions of history here, A, Conrad's and our timeline, but we're also seeing iterations, different iterations on Conrad's version of history. Like in one version, he marries Count Lambert's daughter. In another version, he marries Lady Francine, who we'll meet later. And it turns out that what they used to know about well, you can't change established history, you can't make it didn't happen, as they say, that's out the window. There's actually a conversation that Conrad has in book five with Tom, with his uncle. His uncle, his cousin. I'm a little hazy on the family, but basically, it's the author coming to Conrad, or God coming to Conrad, whoever. Some Deus Ex Machina coming to him and saying, "Hey, you're a hero. You've changed everything that we know about time travel."
So they could have just gone and gotten him.
Yeah, pretty much.
Cool.
There's again, that Mystery Science Theater refrain. Just repeat to yourself. It's just a show. You should really just relax.
Fair enough. Well, folks, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of this book, The Cross Time Engineer. But yeah, that's the general framing of who this Frankowski fellow is. And yeah, this whole book is told aside from the brief interludes that Lenore referred to. As it's in first person, it's the diary of our character, Conrad Stargard, that he's writing sort of as his confession, he says sometimes, just kind of so he can vent his thoughts. And I'll say just off the bat, just kind of to play my hand here, my thoughts on the book are I am very interested in conceptually, and it's pretty competently done. But I hate Conrad Stargard so much. And you can't escape Conrad Stargard because the whole book is told through first person perspective.
Now,
So it colors the whole thing.
there's actually one improvement on that front here, which is starting in High Tech Knight, you do get POV characters other than Conrad. Sir Vladimir in High Tech Knight, Pyotr Kolchinski, his sidekick in the third book. But again, I mean, Frankowski does some funny things with it. Like there's stuff. He does a little bit of like Rashomon here, like retelling the same event from different perspectives, and seeing how the 13th century people observe it. Like, oh, this thing that they observe as an act of God is actually not this. Oh, Conrad's actually just like toying with this guy he's in a trial by combat with, rather than fighting for his life. So there is some funny narrative switch ups here. But yeah, no, I completely agree. Conrad himself is pretty wretched.
But it opens up basically setting up the idea that there is some kind of time travel agency. It's not particularly important to this book. There's a couple little lore drops where it's like they have a society in like 60,000 something BC where they've made like a super city. Kind of interesting. Doesn't really elaborate much, except you know it's going on. And you know at one point the relative of Conrad does kind of put his finger on the scales to give Conrad the best shake he can in the 13th century. But Lenore, you want to kind of set up who Conrad is and why he's ends up falling asleep in a time machine?
Yes, so initially, so of course, this first chapter is, as you say, from the perspective of Conrad's relative, right? And he is just chewing out this subordinate of his. Here's where we get this is actually interesting. The first line ever delivered in the book is from a woman. And it's where, so right away we hit the ground running with Leo Frankowski's general opinion of women, I think, because this person is just an absolute shrew. She's trying to throw her weight around re her education. She has five doctorates. Of course, she deserves better than her assignment. Her assignment being, of course, being a waitress in 20th century Poland, as one of many people stationed along the time stream to write the definitive history of humankind. And, again, she's whiny. She's written as, not particularly likable. She alludes at one point to, well, I slept with somebody to get a prime position in history. Like this body that I've been incarnated into, Quantum Leap style, is not as hot as my usual body. It you just don't come away liking this person, and it's. On a certain level, on a first read, from a much younger person, it's a little bit funny. But as you go through the rest of the series and as you return to this book, you're like, oh no, like this is just one of three female characters that Frankowski knows how to write. You know, there's either a shrew, there's a wide-eyed ingenue who's sexually accessible, or there's a sexless woman who is teaching young girls to be ingenues.
You know, it's interesting. The first I wrote when I said this in the first two chapters, there's three women introduced, and it's this first character. It's Stargard's like bitch mother. That's how like Stargard would describe her. Like that's the old battle axe complaining about whatever. And then there's a woman that it describes by saying her magnificent pair of breasts entered the room,
She
followed by
literally breast boobily, yes.
yeah. So I was like, I kind of like within like 10 pages, I was like, oh, so this is what we're rocking with. But Stargard as a guy, he's an engineer who is on a sort of break. As a man, he's tall, even by Polish, you know, like his modern Polish standards, you know, generally likes his job, pretty content with life, good at his job, former military, and he is going up into the mountains to buy some seeds for his mother. He doesn't really want to, but he's like down to hike. Gets told by this saleswoman of the seeds that, oh yeah, I'll meet you for a drink afterwards. So he buys like a shit ton of seeds. She doesn't end up showing up despite her, yeah, like you said, she literally has the breast boobily scene. And he ends up drinking himself into a stupor and falling asleep in this tavern in the mountains. That you know, it seems apparently there's another book that explains it, but it was a time machine in the basement, and he walks out into the 13th century, starts wandering down the mountain,
Yes, and
and
worth
it's
noting,
yeah.
it's the woman from the very first chapter, the subordinate at the historical core, as it's called, that leaves the door open for him to wander into.
Yeah. And it's like a mistake. It's not like this elaborate at least, at least not set up in this book as some like elaborate plan or anything. He's just through manner of incompetence and dumb luck, he has wandered back in time into a snowy pass, and he's in pretty serious danger from the get-go because it's now a very, very cold time in the mountains. And as he'll soon realize, there's no, you know, ambulance to call, no military, no anybody. And he'll soon come across a knight who is on the cover of my book here. The cover of it is this guy is standing there wearing the backpack, shocked as a knight rides up on him, and somebody is watching it on a screen, presumably our sort of mystery science theater style time travelers.
Yes, our historical core. And yeah, the knight, of course, is a knight of the Teutonic Order that at this time has taken up residence in Poland. And Conrad at first thinks he's somebody from like the Ren Faire, somebody from like the Society for Creative Anachronism that Frankowski himself would have favored. He's not. He's an actual crossman. And Conrad himself, this was wild to me. Like, Conrad doesn't know this person. He thinks he's some sort of like stranger who's like deep into LARPing or whatever. And he immediately deploys what he calls his command voice, right? His voice from the military. He just shouts at this guy like, "Listen up, you got to tell me where I'm at and what you're about." You know, like which for even for some even for somebody who's being like confusing and kind of obtuse from Conrad's perspective is a wild way to like deal with another human being you've just met.
Yeah, and I want to read just kind of as they meet so you can get an idea of how the writing goes in this.
Yes.
Then a lunatic medievalist trotted toward me down the trail. In retrospect and at a distance, he was not a bad sight. He rode a massive black stallion and wore a white surcoat with a huge black cross. His white shield also bore a black cross, which was repeated again by the eye and nose slit on his authentic-looking barrel of a helmet. He was sheathed in chainmail from his neck to his toes. A lance was at his back, a sword at his waist, and various instruments of mayhem hung over the saddle bow. As we approached each other, the idealized image faded and details became visible. The surcoat was shabby, and the shield was dirty. His chainmail was not of the fine rings seen in museums, but of circles as big as a man's wedding ring and of iron that would have been better used for coat hangers. His helmet and weaponry were of poorly beaten wrought iron, and his horse was not well fed. I wanted to read that, not just so you can kind of get an idea of the tone, but he will spend, you know, two paragraphs on this guy, right? Describing this guy in detail, really not him, but his tools, his armor, his horse. You will not spend long with this guy. You will not see this guy again. The reason I point that out is because he will then brush off entire cities as like it was a muddy little city on the side of the road. And that shows, and it's not right or wrong. It just shows he is, as a writer, very interested in these details of like mechanics of the gear of, well, what was the sword like? What was the pommel? Like I said, I think this guy would have like, I mean, I was joking earlier about him being on like the incel side of Reddit, but I think there's a lot of sides of Reddit this guy would have been very comfortable on, like with this kind of like talking about like the weight of a sword and the this and that and being really into these different ancient mechanisms. And that is, you know, one of the parts of the book that I do. I have, even though it can kind of drag down the narrative at times, I do have a respect for that attention to detail on the sort of gear and his interest in it. And, you know, that clear, I mean, you can tell that the writer, if I mean, we know that Frankowski is an engineer, but even if he wasn't, you would know he's someone of some knowledge and who had, you know, done his reading.
Yes, yes. No, he certainly, you know, again, medieval Europe, particularly medieval Poland, is a personal interest of his. And he likes to show off, as here, you know, this is the first really major sequence where he sets up an image that somebody might have of medieval times, what people might have looked like, and then kind of zooms in and would be like, no, actually, you know, it would be weather beaten, you know, it would be like trail worn, you know, in this, that, and the other way, you know, and it's interesting, you know, I mean, and as well, you know, the prose, again, I have to have praise for, you know, instruments of mayhem, right? You know, iron that would have been better used for coat hangers. It's evocative, you know, like it's, you know, it's no, he doesn't get quite as esoteric as a Lovecraft, of course, but, you know, he works really well with what he has. You know, this is somebody who has, again, run his prose by, you know, groups of like-minded individuals, you know, by his peers, and has, you know, taken and has probably taken criticism in his time, you know, what you're supposed to do, you know.
No doubt. And so Conrad receives a minor injury from this and, you know, decides to pack at the side of the road, start a fire, where he meets a priest who is wandering. And this is where you get the introduction of the very hardcore Catholicism. And when I say hardcore, I don't mean in some kind of, you know, way where he lets it run his life, but he is like a genuine believer, Conrad is.
Yes.
And I find that interesting. Also, you know, and it seems to me like, it seems to me partially just to exist. I know the backstory of why this character is Catholic, like, and sort of in contrast to, you know, Frankowski himself. But I think there's also something to the fact that a Yankee in King Arthur's court, so much of that is around, like, the church fucking up his plans and the church being honestly the big problem in that, like being the reactive force. And in this book in particular, the church isn't like aiding his plans necessarily, but this priest, you know, I'm pretty sure Conrad dies without meeting this guy, and he like gives him his first job and is very helpful. So it is interesting to me that Frankowski is an atheist, and it feels almost like a refutation of Twain's atheism. So it is odd to me that he decided to include that, but it seems self-conscious as a decision.
It seems. I think he's also looking at Catholicism as a historical curiosity, as he would any other aspect of the 13th century Poland that he creates. I mean, you know, we're not gonna. We've discussed Frankowski's politics enough in the first bit of this episode, but there's traces of. I think there's traces of admiration for very specific elements of Catholicism that within the context of who Frankowski was prefigured the sort of a trad-cath trend that you kind of see online here, you know, among reactionaries.
In this priest, what is his name?
Father Ignacy. And I actually like him.
Yeah, no, he's a charming little guy. And also, another detail I'd like to fit out when they're sitting, I'll point out when they're sitting next to each other, he wants to see how badly his feet are frostbitten because this man is walking barefoot through the mountains and says his feet were huge. They were rough, red, and incredibly wide, half again wider than my tennis shoes. The calluses were fully a centimeter thick. I didn't know what the disease was, but it was nothing like frostbite. I touched his feet, rubbed them. They were warmer than my hands. And that's another like thing that it includes. That like those little details about like just this and that in the Middle Ages of like a guy who walks all the time, things like that, did especially kind of in the first half have me engage in a certain capacity. Yeah. And so they decide to become travel buddies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will point out there's a bit early in the book where he explains away how he's able to communicate with these people in 13th century Poland, himself coming from the 1980s. It's a minor digression on the putative stability of the Polish language compared to other languages, right? Like, oh well, you know, like some languages, you know, don't drift as much as English, right? You know, you can read the poem of the Cid, which was written in the 1100s, if you're a modern day Spanish speaker and not need special classes. He says, well, you know, like Polish has managed to stay stable enough that I was a guy with a funny accent, but I could pretty much make myself understood. I drifted into a medieval history forum with questions about that. A few elements of the series, but about that specifically. And the response that I got from somebody who's more experienced in medieval history than I am is, yeah, that's absolute poppycock, right? And he showed me,
Yeah, 100%.
the same sentence rendered in 13th century Polish and modern Polish, and it's drifted as any other language would. But you know, again, that's the sort of thing you can kind of forgive as a necessary sort of a necessary element of making this book work.
Yeah, I think when I talk about the attention to detail, it's not all just about the historicity of it. It's like the book's internal logic, you know? When you're inside the book, this is like the rules of the book. And he is very interested in those, and he's very interested in the world he's creating there and the most minute details of how will they do things inside the world. Unlike, say, like, I don't know, Ken Stanley Robinson, I don't think this feels as like obsessive with showing just showing how much research was done per se, though there was clearly research done. I think it's got a little more to do with this, like it's got these tools in this internal world and then what this character does with them. And he's very excited to move away from this is what the 12th century is like or 13th century is like and move into what this is what this character begins to create with this century's technology. At which point, you know, that's where his creativity starts moving. And I think that's where the real focus on the detail and the science and the stuff comes in. I'm not, yeah, I when I read that about Polish, I'm like, I know that's not true. I took a linguistics class. Like that's not correct. But that doesn't, you know, bother me so much. I do like that he tries to cover his bases by being like, oh, and the time travelers inoculated him and stuff. You know, they're trying to like, and I appreciate that, but at the same time, I'm not, you know, I'm not the guy who's gonna cinema sins ding you for it. It doesn't bother me.
Now, the what you say about detail, I think it dovetails pretty nicely into the next story beat here, which is again one of my favorite sort of conventions is that when you're experiencing something major and traumatic, right, you zero in on like tiny details that sort of tack your brain to things that you can see and touch and feel immediately and sort of, you know, help you process what you're experiencing. And here in the end of chapter two, he's in denial this whole time, Conrad is, that he's time traveled. But finally, he and Ignacy fall in with this peasant family that they whose hut they spend the night in. Now, they're sharing some of their provisions with the peasant family as thanks, right? And here, let's see, here we go. It was obviously my turn. I rummaged through my dwindling food supplies for something that could be divided, that wasn't freeze-dried. I came up with a big 200-gram bar of chocolate. I opened the package and found that the bar was conveniently divided into 14 squares. Following the priest ritual, I broke the bar in half, then a half into seven parts, which I passed around. I gave a piece to the 5-year-old boy, And he just looked up at me. He didn't know what chocolate was. In my world, there are madmen and there are saints. There are murderers and there are people who live in holes in the ground. But there are no boys who don't know what chocolate is. Not in the 20th century, anyway. The truth that I had been fighting off all day was forced in on me, and I could no longer defend myself against it. Father, you've told me that this is November 25th. Will you now please tell me what year it is? It seemed that he had been waiting for that question. It is, in the year of our Lord, 1231. I drew my legs close to my chest and hugged them with my arms. I put my forehead on my knees. There were no policemen, no courts of law. There were no ambulances, no hospitals, and no doctors. There were no stores, no hiking society, and no air rescue teams. There was no rescue at all. There were only brutal knights, crazy saints, and Mongols. In 10 years, the Mongols were coming, and they would kill everybody. I fell asleep. Again, you know,
it works. It works.
It definitely works. You know, the whole enormity of the whole enormity, and he has bits and pieces throughout the book where he's like, "Oh, maybe I could do this." No, I actually can't because I don't have access to 20th century conveniences. But the whole enormity of this thing coming crashing down on him is a very effective sequence. That and there's another bit very late in the book that's my favorite that we'll get into. But again, you know, Frankowski's got a real gift for establishing time and place.
It makes me think of, and we'll read Oryx and Crake at some point, but there's a video game that they get really into in Oryx and Crake called Civilizations and Barbarians or something. And the basic premise of the game is you play as a civilization completely unready to take on a attacking force. And you have a certain amount of time to prepare yourself. And then the attacking force attacks. And in the game, the civilization is the Aztecs and the barbarians are the Spaniards. But there's like apparently different versions of the game, which I think she just threw in there to just be like, hey, by the way, I'm not trying to be racist by using the word barbarian. That's just what they do in the game,
right?
Which I appreciate. I to be clear, I don't think Frankowski would have any problems describing the Mongols in certain terms. I'm worried about what the prose sounds like when they actually do fight the Mongols. That situation that like one is put to imagine, you know, because the Mongols did at this time. I mean, kick Poland's ass. Poland was not ready to fight the Mongols.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Europe got very lucky in general that Genghis Khan died when he did, actually, because like if they took my understanding is the Mongols took quite a break for a while after his death. And provided he had continued to live, you know,
they did, they did. And there's speculation about what would have happened had they gotten into, further into Western Europe. Like, you know, maybe the gut strings on their bows wouldn't have worked well in the wetter weather of the Holy Roman Empire. You know, they never faced.
That's what I like about this book is it's starting to open those questions. Cause yeah, yes. Like the Poles actually, you know, did get pretty beaten pretty bad. And a large part of that was their like political disunity.
Yes.
But this is why like I find this book very interesting as someone who's like trying to think about like historical materialism, right? Mm-hmm. Because this period of history is feudalism. You have a very traditional, that lasted a very long time, feudal form of existence. It is pre-capitalist. So like just very simply, instead of a bourgeoisie and a proletariat, you have a nobility class that is split into a number of much more complicated subclasses that is inherently tied up with a priesthood class, which is an actual separate class. Nobility as the ruling classes and being the ruling class of the government, as the bourgeoisie is of our government. And the nobles basically having peasantry, those peasants living on their land. And interestingly enough, this has been debated to all ends, but interestingly enough, to some capacity, actually controlling production to a certain capacity, their own production, controlling their own commons, and owing a certain slice of it to the Lord, and the Lord owing that in back to them, and the priests existing as sort of a mediating class that gives it all this sort of veneer of religious existence. And whereas, I mean, if you read people talking about writing talk about living at this time, people spend a whole lot of time meditating on God and stuff and feel this deep connection with the divine. No matter, it's unclear. I mean, who knows what's going on there? I'm not the one to break that down, but there were, you know, a lot of people feeling in this sort of communion with divine, communion with the land, people living on the same land, feeling a fundamental ownership of it that they actually would lose at the foundation of capitalism, the destruction of the nobility, because the bourgeoisie were simply more effective. And in this book, Stargardt is kind of playing the role of the bourgeoisie.
Kind frankly. Of. Yeah, it's
before they hit their time.
Yes, we're gonna get ahead of ourselves a little bit here, but you know, to prefigure sort of what Conrad does in going about and modernizing Poland, Frankowski's version of socialism is essentially socialism is when the government does stuff, and the government at this time, of course, is the nobility and the various knights as well. You know,
he seems to approve of the stuff being done.
Which
it's interesting. I actually was surprised that he didn't paint modern Poland, obviously 1986 Poland, with such a sort of positive light, being like a reactionary.
Well, he has really unkind words for, you know, the Soviet Union and its particular brand of bureaucracy. So he gets his licks in that way.
It's interesting though. I guess I have to give him some form of credit for at least writing from his character's perspective.
Yes.
Which is a thing reactionary novels are very rarely capable of doing. I mean, compare it to like Ben Shapiro writing the perspective of somebody like Liron, who is like, and I know it's going to fuck up the world and I don't care. You know, like at least, you know, there's an internal consistency.
First of all, the idea that a 20th century Pole could make himself intelligible to a 13th century Pole is absolute poppycock.
Yeah, exactly. Send Ben Shapiro back to the 13th century. I want to see that.
Oh,
they'd
yes.
Pull up and there would be like, even by our standards, you are a shrimp of a man. No.
If we send him back to the 13th century, he would be then Shapiro.
Yeah, he would become, if he was the stand-in, he would become the Ben Shapiro. I don't know. I'm trying to get to Shup Hero. He becomes the hero. I don't know. Something like that.
The Shup Hero. There we go.
The Shup Hero. The Shop Hero, also known as the bourgeoisie. I don't know. That's not anything. These two, this unlikely pair meets a longshoreman and a poet, the sort of wandering poet archetype, where we manage to get the first really reactionary diatribe.
Oh, boy, do we.
So to be clear, he meets this poet, this guy who's like this wandering poet who was kicked out of college for being in Students for Socialism or something. No, for basically being like a rebel in college.
He's a Goliard, which described a class of student clergy at the time that wrote satires about the church and whatnot.
Yes. So he's a political rebel in college, and much like John Melrod. it's a similar Melrod and this poet would get along. But this poet is now, you know, wandering the world, doing his poetry and working his way through. And he has this interesting bit.
Oh, dope.
Where he says,
oh, dear.
Let me see if I can find it.
Beginning
he had been
four.
Silent since his dunking, and I felt sorry for him. I suppose I was prejudiced. I never met a Goliard poet before, but I knew the type. He was exactly the same as the Lost Generation and the hobos and the beatniks and the hippies and, what were the current group? Punkers, I think. Every decade or so, they all adopt a stranger slang, put on a different uniform and say that I am a conformist and that they are doing something wondrous and new. Groups who change their names every 10 years do it for a good reason. People have discovered that they are bums and they need new camouflage. Now, I am Slavic and proud of it. Slav comes from the old root meaning glorious, but during the first millennium, Western Europeans enslaved so many of us that the word Slav began to mean slave in their languages, which is about as derogatory as you can get. A people without a strong sense of self-worth, I apologize, this is what he wrote, like the American blacks, would have repeatedly changed their own name trying to erase that smudge. But of course we didn't. Try to get a Jew to call himself something different. Same thing. End
no,
quote.
Jesus Christ. No, unpacking the nature of that slavery versus American chattel slavery and how it was industrialized. Like,
Yeah, I'd said great example for this book. Very fun concept. This poet, as a stand-in of a recurring rebel throughout history, ruined by his reactionary tone. A better author could make Conrad reactionary in an interesting way, but Frankowski is trying to write a progressive and failing. Would be more interesting if he actually leaned into this, like being the character. But you just have this moment of suddenly Frankowski, Tim LaHaye style, grabbing the
Yes.
wheel and having to insert himself really like loudly and racistly into the narrative in a very
Yes.
strange reactionary way. That again, I'm not against there like being a character who's a reactionary, but it is really jarring compared
It
to the.
is. It is. Yes. And, again, I'm not the sort of girl who believes that, oh, you write something, you must espouse it. But if you read his website, again, he has a whole essay on Roma people that is just entitled The Gisler, right? And, it's all about, how, oh, these people are terrible and ugly and thieves and they should all be rounded up. He would have gotten along great with Alexei Navalny. May he rot in hell. It's you, if you read his website and if you read these books, you find that, the views of Conrad Stargard, his self-insert to a degree, are inseparable from his own. And who
Which
boy
is
does that.
why, the self-insert thing, people still criticize him for that when I've read about it. They're like, this guy's a self-insert, and his defense is, but he's different than me in so many ways. And it's like, yeah, but not really where it counts to you.
He's still racist, he's still, has all the same interests and opinions as you have,
He's still an engineer. He's still having sex with
I
women
want to,
that don't aren't in position to
oh yeah.
refuse. We'll
I
get to
want to
that.
allude to, yeah, we'll get to that. I want to allude to as well, like Lord Conrad's Crusade is about Conrad being captured and sold into slavery in the Levant. Again, I can only imagine the depths that he sinks to in that one,
Yeah, I'm
because
sure
I
that
haven't
one's
read it
very
yet,
normal.
but I will eventually. And who boy. So they go along the river with Tadeusz the boatman and Roman Bukowski the poet. This is where we get our first little bit of our first little engineering trick that Conrad pulls off. Right, the boat's stuck on the rocks. Right, he passes a rope around a rock upstream and uses essentially forces of what's the
Physics, I
engineering term
guess.
for this?
Oh, I don't know the engine. It's like a simple machine, right?
He basically creates a simple machine. He says, well, we should it'd be better if we had like a pulley or something, but ultimately, like we can manipulate our force and our strength this way to move the boat. Like, again, there's bits of that that are pretty interesting.
Okay, I'll push back a little on that actually. I think there are moments of the engineering that are interesting, and I hate that this is the one that introduced it because people absolutely did know this kind of thing in the 13th
Yes.
century, though, right? Like, there are things that the machines, but I found that to be not even that it's impossible that he would be among people who didn't know that because just because some people knew it didn't mean everyone. But it feels weird to me that, like, the introduction of what this whole guy's shtick is going to be isn't something that's like uniquely modern. Maybe that's a very small nitpick. But I don't know. My thought process is like, this is one of the things that this boatman would know this would if he lived on the river. You know what
Yeah,
I
and like,
mean?
I mean, Tadeusz knows what a pulley is at one point. Actually, Conrad comments on that, like, now how the hell can a guy know what a pulley is and not know about, like, gain and loss of force and that sort of thing?
It's
It's
not a
this,
big deal. It's just kind of like odd to me that it was the introduction of this recurring thing that
Yes.
happens in more interesting ways later on.
It's this weird line that he walks between these people being ignorant of, like, things that are obvious to him as a 20th century man, and these people also sometimes coming up with solutions that he himself just had never occurred
Because,
to
yeah,
him.
on the one hand, like, there are some things that these people cannot know due to their lack of technology or to the fact that they just, like, haven't been introduced to things like Arabic numerals. On the other hand, like, the day-to-day, like, practicality of certain things, there's no reason that they, like, can't know.
Right. Now they get into town and they spend the night at the inn, and the inn, of course, is full of fleas. Conrad can't sleep, so he goes back
Oh, I hate
to the
that.
boats. God, I've dealt with fleas in my household before. Like, it's a fucking nightmare. Like,
Would you prefer fleas or bats?
oh God, can I choose to kill myself?
The bats could eat the fleas if you chose both, but
Oh, there we
maybe
go.
it
Well, you know, and well,
once
then
was
you,
a lady who swallowed a fly.
well, you know, and then you get into the Porky Pig cartoon, right? You know, he gets dogs to chase out the cats, he gets elephants to chase out the dogs, he gets mice to chase out the elephants, and you're back where you started.
Yeah, and then you get a 20th century pole to chase out the Mongols.
There we go. There we
Yeah.
go. That's well, in most timelines, incidentally, he fails. He becomes like the town blacksmith at best. This is the one that succeeded.
Gotcha.
So he goes to the boat to sleep because he has an open invitation from Tadaus. There's a scuffle with some highwaymen. They manage to kill all three of them. Conrad, of course, has his first really, really major culture shock of the era, which is, oh my God, you know, we've just killed these guys. And again, it's an interesting dynamic that Frankowski strikes here. Because, you know, from Tadaus's perspective, this is a completely reasonable thing to do, is to, you know, kill these people that have tried to kill you and to, you know, just move on with your life and hide the bodies, right? Because he's like, look, you know, these people from this town likely have a dozen men apiece, you know, friends and family members ready to swear to their good character. Like, you know, if I were to involve the authorities with this, I'd be in jail for at least 6 months.
Right, and it does introduce, Conrad is tall again, even by modern standards. So of course he's very tall by this century standards, and he's military training and apparently in college studied fencing and was really good at it. So we'll say sure, why not? And we'll give it to him. So yeah, this does give him like this natural advantage, even though he's not a killer. Introducing a large modern person into that context, yeah, they would certainly have a leg up when it comes to just like a fist fight.
Right. Not that he does anything in that fight. He spends most of it trying to open his jackknife.
Yeah, but he will kick some ass later on.
He will, yes, especially in High Tech Night. That's all about a trial by combat. Speaking of modern standards versus medieval standards, they get lunch at one point, and a young girl sits down with them. She looked to be about 12 years old and underfed. Her dress was dirty and patched, and she was not clean. She was barefoot, and she was trying to smile and keep her eyes off the steaming bowl of stew in front of me. It transpires that this girl is about 12 years old. She's been living in the city for a couple of years, and she makes her living as a prostitute. Horrific. Of course, Roman, you know, the Goliard poet of the set, initially tries to solicit her services, and Conrad shuts him down. You know, he correctly says, look, you know, like, you're forcing this girl. What is his way that he puts it? What? Roman exploded. Sir Conrad, this is a foul jest. Conrad has paid the innkeeper to hire this girl for 3 days instead. If you won't make use of her, then by the muse, I will. By God, you will not. What will you tell Father Ignacy when you next confess to him? That you took an adolescent girl by force? What force? She offered and you paid. Roman stood. She was forced by hunger and poverty, which are more persuasive than any sword or club, and a good deal more brutal. Now sit down and finish your beer. Again, one could be forgiven for assuming that Frankowski has read his Alexander Kollontai at some point. Prostitution and ways of fighting it, of course, but
Yeah, it seems like this guy's a feminist and everything will be fine.
I seems, but oh boy. This it
Also, I
turns
guess
around.
we'll just go ahead and give the warning that we're gonna talk about some like sexual assault stuff that happens in this book. So like,
Yeah, there's
you
some.
probably picked up on this already, but like, yeah, I guess if that's something that like, I won't get in the nitty-gritty here, neither does this book, but if that's something that is triggering to you, maybe you can be forgiven for turning off the episode at this point.
So, yes, ultimately he falls in, Conrad does, with a traveling merchant of Ignacy's acquaintance, Boris Novacek, and Boris is on his way to the small town of Okowitz. And Conrad, of course, gets a job as a bodyguard because he's a big guy. He's handy with a sword. They go around, they get him some armor, they get him a weapon, which, by sheer chance, the weapon happens to be one of many gifts from Conrad's relative at the historical core. It's a watered steel blade with a diamond edge that basically is magic in this era. Conrad can cut through just about anything with it.
Yeah, it says here, I took it over to the light and rubbed the blade. It was watered steel. The best sword steel is made of thousands of thin layers of hard, high carbon steel welded between layers of flexible low carbon steel. The high carbon steel corrodes less quickly, and the result is a surface that looks like ripples on water, hence the name. This was the first good piece of metal I'd seen in the 13th century. So once again, we get back into sort of the interests of Frankowski and frankly, what he's good at.
Yeah, exactly. And he finds as well a horse that has been genetically engineered. She,
It's familiar.
yes. And again, like, I will defend that scene where he meets the girl in the seed shop a little bit because she gets one over on him because he's a horn dog and he's too like horny to notice that she's swindling him. But he ends up naming the horse after her, Anna.
Very strange.
Yes, and that just kind of becomes a running joke throughout the book.
She does end up, that horse is pretty cool though. It's like, didn't they say the horse has like a 70 IQ compared to a human or something like that? Which
Yeah,
like IQ
she.
obviously bullshit measurement,
Yes.
but like the fact that this is a horse that is almost an average human is wild.
She understands Polish. She can communicate. Her spelling is terrible, as Dracula alluded to in the early part of the episode.
Yeah, good
But
on her for that.
she's very, very intelligent. Also, can run faster than any regular horse for much longer, and can eat anything. Literally anything. She eats. There's a bit in book four where a Mongol emissary is telling the Poles to surrender, and Conrad's like, "Oh yeah, Anna, can you eat that tree for the nice man?"
The fuck?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. So they go on. There's a bit where he and Boris run into a pack of highwaymen, and not only do they stumble across a
Well, they kill
big.
a random guy at some point that comes and demands some money from them too. There's
Yeah,
two
yeah.
encounters with highwaymen.
Yeah, creditor of Novacek's.
But the highwaymen fight is a little more notable. And it's also notably the opening of the book is an excerpt from the highwaymen fight. At least it is in my
It
edition.
is,
I
yes.
actually was going to ask you your thoughts on this. Because okay, but yeah, like you were saying, these highwaymen come upon them, and these are like, trained fighters. You got this big old knight that's quite dangerous and stuff, and it says. And just the opening of the book, you open the book and it says, "My man reached for his dagger and I slashed his right hand off at the wrist. He slumped to a sitting position on the snow, staring at the blood spurting from the stump of his right wrist. Meanwhile, my war horse had her man on the run. Suddenly, he ducked behind a massive oak, then craftily peeked from the opposite side to see what had become of her. As his head came round, she put a forehead in his face. I could hear the crunch from 50 meters away. She sniffed briefly at the body, calmly stepped on its neck, and trotted back to me. I wondered briefly how one trains a horse to do such things, then decided I didn't want to know." So yeah, obviously pretty, well done battle scene far as those things go. And there's more to it than that, but it's a fight. There's a moment where he sticks his sword in the helmet of the guy and says, like, he cuts him up like a like an apple, the head's an apple or
Yeah, because the
something.
sword turns around and basically just like takes off the top of the guy's head. It's pretty gruesome, but
But my question is, why the hell is that the opening page of the book, do you think?
I mean, honestly, it tells you right there that not only is this guy a fighter. I mean, the header for this excerpt we should point out is a well-trained animal, right? Immediately, what you're reading here is, oh, wait a minute, this book has a super intelligent horse. And I know it's about time travel. What is all this about? So it's, I think it's an effective bit of giving you a peek behind the curtain, about everything the historical core is capable of.
This is a pretty, it's not uncommon, especially from 70s and 80s, sci-fi, fantasy, really pulpy kind of genre novels to have excerpts from the book at the very front as kind of like a, I think they were really like imitating the some of the style in film, that liked to do that. Show a scene later in the movie that was a big kind
Yes.
of popular trope in the 70s, remains as such. I just find that to be a really bizarre choice, especially because you'd think the horse would be a lot more important. Anna the horse kind of
She.
gets forgetting it is forgotten in the last quarter of this book or so.
Yeah, but she you'll definitely if you were inclined to read the rest of the series, she's pretty ever present throughout. As it happens, she can reproduce at will. And so can her descendants.
Sorry, she can
And
do what?
it's parthenogenesis. She can
She's horse Jesus?
yeah,
Or
literally.
Horse Mary, rather, I
Yeah,
suppose.
literally,
A Mary.
The horses are intelligent enough that they get the name Big People, and they're treated as kind of second-class citizens.
I
And
see.
though not in time for the Mongol invasion, they eventually become a critical part of the infrastructure of the Poland that Conrad builds. It's pretty interesting.
No one's allowed to steal the mayor e joke. That's a free tweet for me when I decide to. Once I've seen a, if anyone posts about a horse giving birth without a stallion, I'll have that instantly locked and loaded in the barrel.
We'll contact the historical core and actually have that tweet deleted before it's even posted.
Thank God.
Because as it turns out, you can make it didn't happen, but we'll not get into that. So they the highwayman fight ends with they find a kid among the highwayman's camp. Well, they find, first of all, like a stash of silver and gold that makes Conrad wealthy beyond all rational comprehension in this era, which allows him to do all the investments and hiring that he needs to get his industrial base off the ground. So, you know, there's that gloss there, A, that addresses that. But they
Primitive
find a.
accumulation, as they
Yeah,
will.
ex yes, exactly. Primitive accumulation. And he find they find a kid as well. Boris is like, look, that kid's. Look, that kid's probably gonna die out here. You know, we don't know when we're gonna get to a settlement. You might as well leave it. And Conrad's like, no, I'm gonna save this child. Which turns out to be a good idea because they get to Sir Miesco's manor. Sir Miesco is a knight in the service of the local lord, Count Lambert. And the Lambert's handmaidens and Sir Miesco's wife, of course, take them in. They take the kid in, so everything's fine. That's actually the major point of divergence, as the historical core points out later. In other timelines, Conrad didn't save the kid, he didn't get the time of day from the handmaidens, and thus not from Count Lambert, and he just kind of muddled along. This is the real point of divergence, and the first major one, as is pointed out later in the series, in Conrad's adventures.
Interesting, interesting. Well, it's
Also,
nice of him to do for sure.
well, do you want to know a really vile corollary to that?
Sure.
He fucks that kid in book six.
What?
Chapter one, it's 13 years later. She comes back, and the text explicitly states that she's 13 years old. She's got the body of an 18-year-old, and she seduces Conrad. She disappears, never to be seen again.
Wow. I guess
So he.
that's a good a jumping off point as any to talk about what happens next.
Yeah, you begin to see why that sixth book really parted to Frankowski's ways from traditional publishing.
And he doesn't wait though to the sixth book to get into pedophilia because despite the thing about the 12-year-old earlier, him deciding, hey, don't fuck a 12-year-old, 14-year-old's not too far a jump for him. Because at this point, we introduce the character of Christiania. Is it Christiania? Christiana?
Christiana, yeah, to the degree that she is a character.
Christiania and the other handmaidens at the estate are basically, you know, they're servants and they also exist basically as like sex slaves to the knights. The book kind of shades it by being like, they're hella into it. The knight has the right to have sex with any woman they want. And it plays off of there is not necessarily everywhere, but there were places where it was customary for knights to have the right to take any common born woman they wanted and have sex with them. Obviously, horrifying practice. And it really takes that practice, which was real, and turns it into something like sexy that the women wanted. And that's quite vile, not just because it's with a 14-year-old, but also because it's a real shit that happened and it's turning it into like a that.
He literally pulls a what if the child consents, right, when Christiane is laying it all out for him. Again, you know, somebody who, in theory, when he's talking about Malenka, the prostitute, earlier in the book, right? In theory, he understands, okay, these forces are driving her to commodify her sexuality, and thus taking her, you know, is tantamount to rape, you know, regardless of what money changes hands. And yet he doesn't have that same logic when Christiane is explaining, well, you know, like girl sleeps with the knight and then perhaps like her family will get a dowry for marrying her off. So like, I mean, there's still an economic incentive there.
I mean, it describes her like when he's, it says, I couldn't call Christiania beautiful, but she was certainly pretty. She had lovely long blonde hair that was draped over her shoulders. It went well with her light blue eyes and blonde, almost unnoticeable eyebrows and lashes. Her nose was perhaps a little too long. Her mouth was too wide and her teeth were not good. but there was nothing ugly about her. I mentioned that she was tall, but only in comparison to the others. Now her head was at shoulder level, and her stretched out toes brushed my shins. Her body was slender and most acceptable. She looked younger than I had thought last night. Perhaps she was 16. I found out later that she was 14, the usual age of marriage. And I think he plays on here. I think his concept here is just kind of like, if you asked Frankowski, he would be like, well, that was the age people were like being married off in the Middle Ages. And in some cases that's true. In some cases it isn't. But this isn't a look at how they lived. This is a sex fantasy of this like insert character who has sex with as many young horny women as he wants.
Yes. Yeah, no, exactly. Like even back then, you know, when marriageable age and childbearing age was much, you know, lower than it ought to be, there was a difference between marriageable age and childbearing age, you know, and like he's taking a license here that is just vile.
And, you know, I guess I want to come back to too, is like, this book isn't just like depicting it being like, this guy's a monster. Like, this book is very much like inviting you to be kind of excited by this.
Oh, literally, like at several points throughout the series, you know, Conrad remarks on, you know, like it's normal for any red-blooded man to be interested in like young teenage girls. No, it fucking isn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this becomes his thing since he's a knight at the castle. There's all, and it's like a running thing throughout it. Christiania is the main one, but there's all these women that he's like occasionally having sex, not occasionally, she's having sex with every night. They switch out with him. At one point there's like a pair of them and it's like, they like to work in a team. Really, Jesus. Really fun stuff. And everything in the castle, like, there's other stuff that's happening too, but it's just kind of a very pervy veneer. At a certain point, there's a festival, and there's the Lord of Misrule is introduced, and he's like made to drink breast milk from like a bunch of different women. And like, it's just like, he gets just really bogged down in horniness in these parts. And
yes, yes.
It the could Lord be forgiven, I guess, if they were adults at the least, but they are not.
The Lord of Misrule, as opposed to the local lord who we've mentioned, Count Lambert, who by this time he has met. Count Lambert being the, his seat is at Okowitz. You know, all the handmaidens are in service to him. And Lambert, I actually kind of like Lambert as a character, just because, you know, he's boisterous. You know, he leaps into everything headfirst. You know, as the series goes on, you know, Conrad's inventions, he wants to be at like the forefront of them. When Conrad gets into building balloons, when he's testing out flight, right? Lambert wants to be one of the first people to go up in one of those hot air balloons, regardless of the danger to himself.
It was cool of Lambert to invent throwing bread. Stupid joke. Is that a restaurant even around anymore?
Wait, what restaurant?
I'm talking about Lambert's, the restaurant where they throw bread at you.
I've never heard of this.
Sounds like it's not around anymore. There's a restaurant called Lambert's where they throw bread at you. That's the whole thing. I went there one time and I have no memory of even what I ate there aside from a roll that was chucked in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Really weird premise for a restaurant.
I would go once, you know, as we get into late in the book, you know, novelty in a eating and drinking establishment is a big thing.
But yeah, so he's here and immediately, you know, using his knowledge to be like, hey, you know, if you do this, you can raise bees. Hey, if you do this, you can improve your steel, your iron into steel. You could really improve your weaving. And he's got a few knickknacks from his backpack, you know, the binoculars, the compass, some chocolate, and he's introducing that to people to really win them over. And at this point, he does not continue on in his quest. He stays here where he will remain and work his way up from like knight to lord to baron to whatever in the future, because he is now building his industrial base. And he swears fealty to Lord Lambert for 9 years, just in case he needs to dip the fuck out. Just before the Mongol invasion. But which, and also I find this interesting. He does. He doesn't tell anyone he's from the future, aside from the priest who makes him swear not to tell anyone.
Yes.
But he
yes.
does tell him that the Mongols are coming. Which leads most people to think he's insane in that aspect, and some other people to be like, maybe he's from an emissary from a faraway kingdom, you know. Who knows? But
There's also kind of a running. They're also kind of a running joke there because everybody's like, "Why are you calling them the Mongols? They're called the Tartars," you know.
Right. Yeah. It's nevertheless, he does get position here because his modern looms and his steel and his waterworks and all his plans, they do work.
He's responsible for introducing the polka to Poland, as it
Also
happens.
that I do like that.
There's bits and pieces of like the modern day that he introduces, like in the second book, I think. Sir Vladimir, one of his friends that he makes is like, oh yeah, you know, all the kids love him and his tales of, you know, nine-fingered Frodo and Luke Skywalker.
That's awesome. I do like that. That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's
And
very there, you know who doesn't think he's funny? Sir Stefan.
okay, does anything come of this Sir Stefan guy? Because nothing does in this book.
So eventually, I mean, spoiler alert for the rest of the series, Sir Stefan, of course, doesn't hit it off with Conrad. There's bad blood between them because
Conrad.
Stefan,
Yeah, it's.
well,
I would dislike Conrad if I was him.
Well, well, for different reasons, right? Stefan ends up having to do a guard, ends up having to pull guard duty for like 17-hour shifts because you're doing it all night while you're in the winter. And, you know, Count Lambert is like, look, you know, I could put this new guest, this new knight that I've sworn into my service on guard duty with you, but you know, and give you a break. But like, I have this guy who's, you know, Conrad's promised to make all these like wonderful like engineering marvels for me, right? So I can't do that, you know. The schedules are already locked in, you know, like Sir Stefan, you know, in Frankowski's words early on, Sir Stefan has a legitimate bitch here, right?
Yeah, I'd be mad about that. I'd be tired all the time.
Yeah, but ultimately, like, it becomes kind of one note. You know, Stefan, you know, just assumes that everything that Conrad does is witchcraft and is terrible, you know. And so does his father, Baron Yaroslav, right? You know, as happens later in the series, right? You know, Yaroslav's barony ends up being like the most underdeveloped because they haven't adopted any of Conrad's like agricultural or infrastructural reforms. There's a sequence late in the book where Stefan invites Conrad to a spot of bear baiting. Do we want to get into bear baiting?
Well, do you
For those of you
go for it?
who don't know about medieval blood sports, you know, and I'm by no means an expert. I've just read about this shit here and there. Bear baiting is you catch a bear and then you let loose some dogs on it, and the sport is betting on how many dogs the bear can take out before it gets torn to shreds. Pretty brutal. There's a blood sport called fox tossing that I won't get into here, but it's wild. Like, they came up with crazy shit back then. But you know, so Sir Stefan offers to settle their differences with a friendly bet on bear baiting, and Conrad's like, no, you know what? I'll buy the bear from you if you don't you know, torture this animal. And Stefan doesn't take the offer, and so Conrad ends up cutting off the bear's head, and Stefan responds by throwing it at Conrad. Like, come back here, you. We're not done here. And that's what gets them both in trouble. That's the first real trouble that Conrad's in, you know, is
Doesn't
with
really last though.
it doesn't really last, you know, and Stefan definitely gets the worst of it. I mean, Lambert's explanation of bear baiting is intriguing to me. Like, look, you know, Conrad, like, you know, bears tear apart our livestock and our, you know, peasantry all the time. You know, we have the right to revenge, you know. It's a sequence to my mind, if a little bit skewed in Conrad's favor, you know, it does illustrate, look, you know, even if you're a good, you know, quote unquote socialist, you know, if you're trying to, you know, modernize, again, you know, like the Cuban Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, right? You know, socialist forces did land reform and other progressive reforms in places that they held power to show the citizenry, like, look, you know, things could be better if, you know, we all participated in this mutually beneficial project. But there's things that Conrad just has to meet people where they're at on, you know, there's things that there's aspects of their culture that he can't change overnight.
Yeah, there's aspects of their culture that he makes worse. He introduces Hooters to their society, but we'll get to that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So at this point, Conrad decides he is going to start developing the productive forces. He's done some primitive accumulation, getting all this money. Now it's time to start really building out some infrastructure. And he's like, eventually I'm going to need factories. I'm gonna need all of this. I'm starting with light industry, with looms and stuff to make basically everyone around me trust me to make some more money, more capital. I guess it's not capital at this point, but you know what I'm saying. And now he's like going out, one on like sort of an errand to deliver a letter for his lord, but also he's going to like find some people who can do like work with different types of metals, different types of clay. And in the process, accidentally, as I said, creates Hooters.
Yes, he there's an inn called the Battle Axe that he falls in with, and
Great
to
name, by the way, for the inn. So mad that he changes that. The Battle Axe is a phenomenal name for an inn,
yeah,
especially if
but
you decide the double meaning, of it. Have you ever heard the term battle axe used for like an old woman?
The old battle axe, you know, it's like it's a staple in any like, you know, boomer like I hate my wife routine.
Yeah, I saw though there was like an account of like this older woman who called herself a battle axe, and she said she's like reclaiming it, like, and she's like got like it was super cool. She's got like actual like swords and axes on her wall, and she's like, yeah, I'm a hell yeah, I'm a battle axe. It's like a
Okay.
60 something year old woman. She was super cool. But if it was like, listen, dive bar for older women to hang out called the Battle Axe, right there. Perfect.
That
Perfect.
sounds like the old, yeah, exactly. No, I would love that. Are you kidding me? That
But
sounds like
what
something
does
that
he
would exist.
actually do, Lenore? Tell us.
Oh yes. So he gets to drinking with Todoos the innkeeper. They get drunk, and I mean it's a little bit funny. Like he goes, yeah, socialism, Todoos. What Poland needs is socialism, and that's how we're gonna fight the Mongols. And he doesn't really go into explaining what socialism is when Todoos asks. He's just like, look, you know, with sufficient organization and technology, like we can make a better society. And it's like, okay, like, well, there's nothing about like collective ownership, right? It's again, because again, nothing in this book is collectively owned as he sets it up. You know, he just swears people to him and pays them a fair raise. But what transpires is that he introduces while they're drinking, they come up with a way to improve the inn. And what that way is first of all, they change the name to the Pink Dragon. And then they're like, okay, we're gonna hire young girls as waitresses. They're gonna be dressed up in like Playboy Bunny outfits. The rules are gonna be look but don't touch. And we're gonna spread rumors that like Conrad, who buys the inn, by the way, they don't tell people that Conrad buys the inn and the subsequent franchise. But they're like, look, you know, this new lord, Sir Conrad, who with all these marvels that he's building, frequents this particular inn that has the hottest waitresses in the land. By the way, the waitresses are also like verified virgins. Which again, the science of that is
Can't
just
do that. Not a real thing.
no, yeah.
Also just weird, just freakish also. And that includes, by the way, the crowd like voting on who like the hottest girl to hire is. It's bad. And then it leads to a scene where the prostitute guild basically or the guild of I don't know exactly.
The Guild of
It's basically
Whoremasters.
yeah, the Guild of Whoremasters. It's not like a this isn't like the Mox from Cyberpunk or something. Like this isn't like prostitutes banding together to protect themselves. These are like the pimps, a guild of the pimps, basically.
Yeah, the class
Tries
of
to
people, the class of people who invented the term sex work.
right. This guy, these guys kind of try and intimidate them. They're like, you're cutting in our market. They kind of misunderstand. And Conrad has, you know, another hero Conrad moment, and he like takes down three guys unarmed, and has there's kind of a comedic moment where a guy gets like pinned to the roof and is like
I was
hanging
just
there
thinking
with
about
a knife
that.
stuck in him. You know, there's it's a little slapsticky, it's a little power fantasy. I don't really begrudge it too much. It's kind of the kind of thing that shows up in this sort of novel. And then, you know, now everybody likes him. You know what this book reminds me of. Now I know what it is. It was scratching the back of my head. Have you ever read Wizard's First Rule?
Oh, Terry Goodkin, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I know of it. It was lying around the house along with some other Goodkind as I was growing up, but I didn't get into him.
Conrad Stargard is Richard Rohr. That they are the same guy. I'm now realizing this, but
The libertarian wizard, right?
yeah. He's a libertarian wizard, and he's all the women want him, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But specifically thinking about like the Superman who like the fun of the book is that this guy always wins and always kicks ass in like interesting ways. Sometimes the author, sometimes Terry Goodkin, is actually good at coming up with a very creative way for Richard to win. And it's always a power fantasy, but he's actually kind of creative with how the power fantasy is carried out.
Yes.
Therefore, it is made somewhat interesting. Like,
there's
it's
a right
not
way to
just.
do these things. Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm there is a right way to do these things. Absolutely.
Right. And it's still like, it's never going to be great. You know, at the end of the day, it's still going to kind of be schlock, but like, there's, we all like our genre fiction.
Yeah.
To
Again,
be
you know, I
clear.
read these books like once a year.
Right. And that's fine. It's to be clear with Terry Goodkin, I haven't read those since high school, but if I remember correctly, like there's one moment where he's fighting against the communist government. Yes, literally, that's in the book. And to defeat them, this is so cool. All the people have gathered and he unveils a huge block of marble and he's chiseled it so perfectly that he hits a crack and it breaks and it falls into the shape of the most beautiful man and woman they've ever seen. And it shows them the glory of humanity. And he basically is like, you're all individuals, not a collective. Look how beautiful they are. And they
Yes,
rise.
we're all individuals. I'm not.
And they rise and overthrow their government.
Okay,
Because of this.
That's pretty funny.
It's hilarious. And he's dead serious about it.
Mm.
And that's why that. But this is reminding me this now, I think Frankowski would be horrified by the like physics of that. But there is something of that living in this book. And I'm going to have to like further flesh out the comparisons in my head. And maybe we have to do a Wizard's First Rule episode.
Eventually,
And also return of a segment, character, Jacob's, I could save him character of the week, is Richard Rawl. I had a massive crush on him in high school.
Oh, let's go.
Maybe if I reread it, I'll be horrified by saying that. But I
Hey.
recall having a massive crush on him in high school.
Hey, maybe, I mean, we got long series summer ahead of us, but maybe next January, Jacob's Crush January. Let's go.
Maybe. Worth noting, Wizard's First Rule also has Femdom Elite Strike Force. And it's literally, that's what they do. They're literally Femdom's Strike Force. And their only weapon is like a baton that like it tases you and like turns you on.
You have my attention.
It gets into some weird shit, including they all, one of their things they have to do to get sworn into their order is dom their dad. Yeah, it's look, no one said Terry Goodkin. Look, I'm just saying, I think Frankowski and Goodkin could have had a conversation. That's all I'm saying.
I would be very surprised if they didn't encounter each other, at least each other's work at some point.
Yeah, forum buddies. Anyway, back to this strange book that doesn't have incest. It just has the other stuff. So at this point, I mean, I'm going to ask you, is the point that Frankowski is trying to drive home here that the socialist has become a capitalist and therefore like capitalism is epic, or is that an accident?
I mean, that is actually the note that he ends on, if I remember correctly.
Right. Actually, yeah.
Yeah, from the very final.
And I know that's jumping slightly forward. I mean, we're close to the end of the book here, but
yeah.
I want to ask that because this whole section here is about the building of the productive forces.
Yes.
And that's like the political angle of this book, outside obviously like the misogyny and stuff, is kind of something that's like been a brainworm, like Frankowski's intent with that.
Yeah. And, you know, here we go. The very last paragraph of the book, and we'll jump back as well. As we left for the banquet hall, Tom put his hand on my shoulder and said, "What tickles me is the way Conrad keeps on talking about building socialism, while at the same time taking all of the actions a 19th century capitalist would approve of, buying businesses, making them profitable, reinvesting the money." I mean, I think that is a little bit of a wink from somebody who hasn't really gotten into, you know, I mean, it's somebody who hasn't read about the new economic policy, to my mind,
sure.
Right? Because, I mean, the reason you couldn't institute socialism immediately once the Bolshevik Revolution kicked off is that the country was starving. There was no, like, infrastructure with which to establish a society of mutual, of, you know, of a minimal living standard, right? You know, so you had to integrate the peasantry, and you had to integrate, the broad masses into an economic system in some way, some controlled form of capitalist relations. You know, now of course you had a explicitly socialist party guiding this that could eventually, you know, turn the ship back that way, but you don't get the sense in these books that that's what Frankowski has in mind.
Sure, nor what Conrad has in mind.
I mean, the same person.
Right. Conrad is talking. There are moments where Conrad's like, I have so much wealth compared to these people. This is wild. This is not a good socialist principle. But also, you know, I'm existing within my conditions. But like, it is weird that he's like, I'm going to socialize this bar by giving you a good wage. Is that Frankowski's ignorance? Or is he saying, look at this communist who's actually not one when he gets some money? Which one is it, do you think?
I think it's a little bit of both, personally. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, in the beginning, you know, he finds all that money, and that's explicitly like how he is able to do all these things. Sure. You know, I think Frankowski at the end of the day is saying, look, you know, money makes the world go round.
Which, like, you know, more or less, actually, in this era, less. That's the interesting thing is I do think, I mean, and this would get into some like CinemaSins Ding territory, but like that it does kind of overvalue what money would be worth to just a dude walking up to a castle in the 13th century. But you know, that's neither here nor there. But
he does get into the economics of it in the fourth book. Because all the trade he gets going and all the money he has flowing around actually causes a like deflationary crisis that he has to address at one point.
That's awesome. That's kind of funny. I like that. So yeah, the book kind of wraps itself up with he's meeting his lead, the Lord above the Lord, and he's introducing all this tech, and there's a hunt.
Loves, by the way, when he's introducing the upper nobility here, you know, because of course Count Lambert by this time is his liege lord. Count Lambert's liege lord is Duke Henrik the Bearded, who is this. I like Henrik. You know, he's a charming old man. But his son, Prince Henrik the Pious, is. It's interesting to me how Frankowski introduces him. Duke Henrik the Bearded was one of the most remarkable men I had ever met. He was almost 70 years old, and his face was cracked and wrinkled like old timber, yet his back was straight and strong. His thick white hair brushed his shoulders, and his thick white beard was huge. It was wider than his chest and extended below his sword belt. But more important than his appearance was this, I don't want to say aura, because that implies something mystical, and this was an immensely practical man, but a feeling of power was almost tangible about him. As if, had he decided to walk through a wall, the wall would have apologized and scrambled out of his way. Even more impressive, though in a totally different way, was his son, who would eventually be called Henrik the Pious. Young Henrik was just over 40, and approaching the height of his powers. He could read and write and did a lot of both, rare among the nobility. Whereas the father was a tough politician, the son was a prince, every centimeter of him. His bearing and his look and his tone of voice were a chant that said duty, justice, order and restraint, honor, vigor, and discipline. We looked each other in the eye, and I knew that this was a man I would follow into hell, fully confident that he could lead me out again. I had found Poland's king and my own.
Down bad.
He's horny, yeah.
Yeah. Down bad. And not much comes of that in this book in particular, but it's obviously setting up future books and the future politics, because, you know, like you said, he kind of banged this thing out very quickly, and this thing is... these books are being written sort of back to back continuously. He's cutting off where it makes sense. But this book essentially ends with they go out in a hunt and he accidentally finds, what is it, a coal mine?
Yeah, a coal mine.
And gets granted the land around it. He gets granted his own little fiefdom. And yeah, the book concludes with him being like, I'm going to take these handmaids. I'm going to set up my little fiefdom and we're going to build weapons and we're going to get ready for the Mongol invasion.
Yes. That's most of what the third book is about. You know, not only getting the industrial base to mass produce weapons, but also building a basic training and, you know, the instructor class for what eventually becomes his army. That's the one point in the entire series where I think he faces what could be a genuine challenge, you know, something genuinely intriguing about his interaction with the nobility. because he invites the, crowned heads of Poland to come see the basic training camp that he set up that they'll, protect their country with. And he muses in the prose that, like I'm showing them the how to build an army and to turn a peasant into somebody who can, dismount and disarm a fully armored knight on horseback while standing in the snow naked. I can make a soldier out of any man. And yet, I'm showing the nobility of Poland this way that I can render them completely irrelevant. I can render the knighthood totally irrelevant. If anybody can fight, why have knights? And that's ultimately what leads to this split in book three between the Polish nobility that they have to resolve, right? Which, again, it's an interesting sort of dynamic that he has to navigate. There's just not enough of that in the book. There's not enough of Conrad starting a problem that he himself can't necessarily resolve the way he'd like.
Yeah, too little of that, and too much of this clay, if you put the iron in and you do the whatever, personally, and maybe that's interesting to some people, personally, I would have been like, he knew how to make steel and he sure did teach him how to do
There
it.
is a little bit of self-awareness in book three, where Frankowski, during one of the interludes, Frankowski has his historical core characters talking about, oh yeah, how did he make that sword again? And the guy's like, oh yeah, I just took a chunk of coal and I put it in a vacuum for 20,000 years at like this amount of pressure to make a solid block of diamond and this, that, and the other. I transferred like most of this diamond forward in time and the rest of this diamond like back in time to get like a perfect edge. And the response is, oh, is that all? I should have guessed. Again, like Frankowski knows when he's waffling. He knows when he's when he has written stuff that he can kind of wink and poke fun at. Unless that stuff is underage girls and how, oh, of course it's normal to be attracted to them. Like there's blind spots that are just fucking vile.
Yeah, big old blind spots.
Frankowski is, to his mild credit, knows exactly what kind of a writer he is, right? There's a section on his website called Should I Buy Frankowski's Books, where he says, some mostly males with military and technical backgrounds often approach me as though I were something holy, like the way I once approached Robert Heinlein. A lot of others get respect, but they have commented me at this excess of almost worship. Others, mostly feminists, liberals, and homosexuals, seem to instinctively hate my guts. I don't know why. He says straight up, look, I'm gonna alienate people with this writing. I know who I'm writing to. If you're not one of those military backgrounded males, maybe spend your money elsewhere. He knows his biases, he knows what he's writing from, and he is wholly uninterested in moving beyond that.
Well, that is sort of also like as like a broader trend, kind of part of what genre fiction allows people to do for better or worse, have a niche audience. You've had periods. I mean, people think of like there was these periods where there's very well selling novels that are very set in a certain genre that get very little popular play. Now the dynamic is different. You've got the internet and you've got kind of the idea of like a novel is a bestseller or it isn't, and this, that, or the other. The idea of kind of niche separate markets has both expanded through the internet, but also the idea of like niche separate markets as connected commercial success sort of has eroded. It's a weird dynamic that I don't fully understand, and always is changing by the time you learn it. But one thing I can say for sure is, he knew his audience, he wrote towards them, and I see why there is an interest in these books. It definitely gets the wheels turning on certain things, thinking about, different histories and stuff like that. It's by no means the most interesting book like that that I have read. I mean, A Yankee in King Arthur's Court is certainly better. God, Years of Rice and Salt is miles better. But that said, it's an interesting premise. Just straight up, you've got 10 years to stop the Mongols as an engineer. That there's something to that, and it's unfortunate that he gets bogged down in reaction and also just straight up pedophilia. More than unfortunate. It's just, it's bad. It's very bad. And it's unfortunate that, well, yeah, no, I kind of that's kind of how I walk away from it. So I walk away from it kind of feeling like, I think going back to that original thing of like, I feel like there's some interesting stuff here. And I think that the most exemplary part of the book for me of how I felt about it is that scene where it's like, hey, it is interesting to say the poet is part of a group that recurs every 10 years differently. And there is this connection between the 13th century and now in this funny way of this guy who is like trying to be a rebel and identifying as a rebel. But unfortunately, due to the author and the author shoving himself into this first person that you can't escape, it's kind of tainted by that. And so, I certainly didn't love the book. But I've had ones that I've hated reading more. I'll say that.
I mentioned that there are two parts of the book that I really do appreciate, and that, like you, allude to something much greater that I think Frankowski would have been capable of had he not been so reactionary, right? There's a part toward the end of the book where there's a logging accident and a peasant gets his foot crushed, and what would ordinarily be a death wound, Conrad ends up he ends up healing the peasant, right? He's like, okay, look, I'm gonna use my what little I know of my first aid skills, and I'm gonna amputate the foot. I'm gonna tie it off this way. And the whole time I'm lecturing people as in carry out the surgery, like on the importance of cleanliness and whatnot, and I'm giving this guy another lease on life. And then I'm paraphrasing here. Then 2 weeks. Then 2 weeks later, he had a fever in the morning and he was dead in the evening. I don't know why. It's effective, like no matter there is this constant sense that, look, no matter how well you do, no matter how much knowledge you bring into a situation, there are some things that you just cannot prevent. You cannot save everybody. You can sure as hell try, but the tragedy is in recognizing where your limitations are. And it's just a shame that Conrad Stargard doesn't have more limitations.
This has been an interesting one, and an interesting cap to our recent run of weird little guys. Whither we go next, I do not know, but you'll find it here at the Socialist Shelf. As Dracula completely left the room, or is he going to make a reappearance at the last minute? Do we know?
No, I think if he does recur, it'll be with an invitation. You have
Well,
to invite him in your home. He's a vampire.
maybe when we do the actual Book of Dracula, how's that?
There we go. There we go.
Well, until then, folks, please, I'm serious, and this is real advice. This is real advice. If you meet a really attractive woman in a seed shop, do not believe her when she says, walk 2 hours down the road and get pissed drunk at an inn. I'll be there any second. It is a trap. I'm speaking from experience. Thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
Peace out.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.